Now, live from the richest country in the world, but too cheap to protect its territorial waters from oil spills, is the Enviro Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Valley Free Radio, Northampton.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. A hurricane, listen to yourself, churn world, serve its own needs, dummy, serve your own needs, beat it up, an ox, beat, grunt, no strength, the ladder starts to clatter with fear, fight down, high, wire in a fire, representing seven games in a government for hire in a combat site, left and west are coming in a hurry with the furies breathing down your neck, team my team, reporters, Babble, Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no pain, fine, death, uh-oh, overflow, population common, proof what it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve its own needs, listen to your heartbeat, dummy,
It's the Invading the Quabbin Enviro Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Dio. I'm here with... What's that? I'm here with the aliens.
Oh, no, that's Glenn Ayers with his little gadget.
Hi, I'm Glenn Ayers.
And I'm Jean Grossel.
There's aliens invading the Quabbin watershed. Some invaders have chainsaws. Some have tendrils and seeds. Don Wakaluk, Assistant Forester for the Department of Consternation and Reprobation, DCR, at the Quabbin from 07 to 09, joins us in the studio to check that out. Of course, these alien clear cuts have been discovered over there as well, and we'll check out that in our evaluation segment.
I thought they were crop circles.
Also, we stagger into the Meet the New Boss segment, as well as check out the Enviro Show Quote of the Week. And the echo chamber, but first it's time for Revenge of the Critters, when Harlequin Shrimp Attack. This is by Chris. Chris is a photographer and a diver. Only an inch or so long, Harlequin Shrimp are one of the most beautiful and elusive critters you can encounter while diving in Thailand. What they lack in size, they make up for in feistiness, though. While diving last week at my favorite Thailand dive site, Koh Aha, I had an unforgettable encounter with two harlequin shrimp, often known as the funky shrimp, on account of their outrageous disco-like outfits. Harlequin shrimp are usually found in pairs, but are also very hard to spot. They are only an inch long and mostly prefer to hide in the crevices of the reef. However, on this occasion, they weren't shy and retiring at all. Once the nearest shrimp had noticed, I was gently nosing my camera into their space to get a photo instead of fleeing into the recesses as their crevices. One of them came straight out at me. Never mind that I'm about 1,000 times bigger than it. The harlequin shrimp proceeds to put on a warning display. It then goes through several different poses, making itself look far bigger than it actually is. It holds each of these poses for a couple seconds and then tries something different to look even more menacing. I left the shrimp alone after the ninja crouch was adopted. I was a bit concerned it might go for my throat. Right. Revenge of the critters. Shrimp. Hey, the shrimp down in the Gulf. They're not having such a good time. They don't have time to do the funky disco dance. Anyway, moving on. The Viral Show quote of the week.
Better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Better stop. Hey, what's that sound?
You may have heard this quote on the corporate media. It qualifies as one of the most outrageous yet to come from the ranks of big oil. Quote, Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean. The amount of volume of oil and dispersant we are putting into it is tiny in relation to the total water volume. Tony Hayward, CEO of British Petroleum. How's that for a quote of the week, folks?
Let me think about that one.
Hey, do you want to play Oil Slick sense. One by Elizabeth Parker?
No, here's what I think about that quote.
Tony Hayward, we have something for you. All right. Let's see. You want to hear Oil Slick One?
Yeah. What is it?
This is a short instrumental from Elizabeth Parker off of page of Oil Spill Tunes. It's rather short, but it's going to take us into the EnviroShow echo chamber rather nicely. Creep from the Deep. In the EnviroShow Echo Chamber, we quite naturally rewind some of the news from the Gulf of Mexico and the BP blowout and their attempted cover-up, as well as Ken Salazar's need for a new job.
I think that by the end of his tenure, we're going to know that Ken Salazar is one of the finest secretaries of Interior we've ever had.
All right.
Who's that, Barry?
That was, and we'll get to him soon enough. The site moratorium drilling project, despite moratorium drilling projects move ahead. How many times can I screw up this headline from the New York Times? In the days since President Obama announced the moratorium on permits for drilling new offshore wells and a halt to a controversial type of environmental waiver that was given to the Deepwater Horizon rig, at least 7 new permits for various types of drilling and 5 environmental waivers have been granted, according to records. The records also indicate that since the April 20 explosion on the rig, federal regulators have granted at least 19 environmental waivers for Gulf drilling projects and at least 17 drilling permits, most of which were for types of work that on the Deepwater Horizon shortly before it exploded. Work like that on. Pouring a ceaseless current of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Asked about the permits and waivers, officials at the Department of Interior and the Minerals Management Service, which regulates drilling, pointed to public statements by Interior Secretary Salazar reiterating that the agency had no intention of stopping all new oil and gas production in the Gulf. And the piece goes on, further on, to state, and we quote, at least six of the drilling projects that have been given waivers in the past 4 weeks are for waters that are deeper and therefore more difficult and dangerous than where Deepwater Horizon was operating. While that rig, which was drilling at a depth of just shy of 5,000 feet, was classified as a deep water operation, many of the wells in the six projects are classified as ultra deep water, including four new wells at over 9,100 feet. So there you have it.
New and improved drilling.
Deeper.
Ultra.
Just a little more, but we'll move on to the next piece. On the worst oil spill ever.
The worst oil spill ever.
By the way, for some really good background on BP and their friends in the Bush regime, check out a Democracy Now! Link on our blog. Just Google In the Enviro Show. All the links we're referring to here will be there. So, according to the New York Times, quote, shortly after Interior Secretary Ken Salazar proposed reconfiguring Minerals Management Services, John Gohl, the head of the Alaska region, called an all-hands meeting, according to a staff member there. Afterward, people lingered to eat cake decorated with the words, what do you think?
Drill, baby, drill.
You're right. Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill.
That's exactly what it said on the cake. For these regulators.
It was, I'm sure it was just a tongue-in-cheek kind of thing.
All right. Well, if it's any
what
comfort,
did you say in what cheek?
Yeah.
If it's any comfort, there are actions. There are protests. I think Greenpeace did one yesterday, and there's some going on around the country. Again, check our blog, Google In the Enviro Show. You'll see the link to the actions. There's a whole website that started up on actions specifically aimed at BP and the situation down in the Gulf. Check out the blog. By the way, hey, how about sending 500,000 signatures to the Prez? 350.org is doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of the Prez,
what about it?
Time to move on to the new boss segment, isn't it?
Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
Yes, it seems the scientists down in the Gulf are not terribly pleased with Obama's people at NOAA. Furthermore, it looks like the U.S. Coast Guard is carrying water for BP.
You should explain what NOAA is.
I will. Right now. This also from...
It's not like Noah's Ark, is it?
No.
No.
No. No, no,
okay.
No.
Maybe that's what we need, though. An oil-proof Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
This also from the New York Times. Scientists fault lack of studies over Gulf oil spill. Tensions between the Obama administration and the scientific community over the Gulf oil spill are escalating, with prominent oceanographers accusing the government of failing to conduct an adequate scientific analysis of the damage and allowing BP to obscure the spill's true scope. The scientists assert that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, otherwise known as NOAA, and other agencies have been slow to investigate the magnitude of the spill and the damage it is causing in the deep ocean. They are especially concerned about getting a better handle on problems that may be occurring from large plumes of oil droplets that appear to be spreading beneath the ocean surface. Scientists point out that in the month since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded, the government has failed to make public a single test on water from the deep ocean. And the scientists say the administration has been too reluctant to demand an accurate analysis of how many gallons of oil are flowing into the sea from the gushing oil well. The big scientific question now is, what is happening in deeper water? While it is clear that water samples have been taken, the results have not been made public. On May 6th,
I'm sure that's to protect national security interests.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could well be. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
On May 6th, NOAA called attention to its role in financing the work of a small research ship called the Pelican, owned by a university consortium in Louisiana. But when scientists aboard that vessel reported over the weekend, and this was last weekend, that they had discovered large plumes under sea that appeared to be made of oil droplets, NOAA criticized the results as premature and requiring further analysis.
Yeah. We got to... We ought to appoint a committee to look into that. don't you think?
They've done that.
Oh, they
commission,
have?
Yeah.
Oh, commission.
Yeah, Barry's
okay.
on that.
All right.
That's why we're talking about the new boss.
Okay,
here.
Yeah, yeah.
Oceanographers have also criticized the Obama administration over its reluctance to force BP, the oil company responsible for the spill, and we might add Dick Cheney and his friends at Halliburton.
Darth Cheney.
Yes. Thank you for correcting. To permit an accurate calculation of the flow rate from the undersea well. The company has refused to permit scientists to send equipment to the ocean floor that would establish the rate with high accuracy. Scientists have long theorized that a shallow spill and a spill in the deep ocean, this one is a mile down, would behave quite differently. A 2003 report by the National Research Council predicted that the oil in a deep water blowout could break into fine droplets, forming plumes of oil mixed with water
kinda
that
like,
would not quickly rise to the surface.
Kind of like mayonnaise.
How many years ago was this?
Yeah.
7 years ago, listeners. That prediction appeared to be confirmed Saturday when the researchers aboard the Pelican reported that they had detected immense plumes that they believed were made of oil particles. The results were not final and came as a surprise to the government.
Mm.
They raised a major concern that sea life in concentrated areas could be exposed to a heavy load of toxic materials as the plumes drift through the sea.
Yes. So I'm wondering when we're going to get to the good news part of the show.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have that in front of me.
You left that. My dog ate it.
Oh, speaking of the New York Times, did we mention that Thomas Friedman is calling the BP blowout Obama's 9/11?
Let's not talk about Thomas Friedman. I'd rather we didn't talk about Thomas Friedman.
All right. Yeah, I know.
I mean, we've got enough bad news.
We don't him on this show, right?
No, yeah.
How about some music to cheer you up?
All right.
Yeah, it's Oil Spill Summer.
It
but,
is.
But.
Here we go.
I hope so.
Yeah.
To do an investigation of where you find this music.
That was just a little tune to cheer you up.
Oh, yeah.
Oil Spill Summer by Butt.
Dear listeners, you'll always remember this as the Oil Spill Summer.
Yes.
All right. It's time to move on to our evaluation segment, and Glenn will give us a reality tour of clear cutting around the Quabbin.
This past week, a group of hardy souls did a hike around the Quabbin, the first hike, Quabbin Walk Number 1. And we started in Orange on Monday and walked Petersham and then continued on around all the way back down south on the east side and then all the way up north. I joined the walk in Belchertown and hiked up to Pelham. And we did presentations along the way for various groups at night, the evening. And the focus of the walk and the focus of the presentations was on the clear cutting that is happening right now in the Quabbin, where the Department of Consternation and Reprobation, DCR, is going in and butchering the forest. That's the only way to describe it. They're going in, wiping out forests that are not even that old. I mean, they're barely teenagers, really. And they're going in with the heavy equipment and just wiping out patches of the forest, 2-3 acres at a chunk, and completely removing everything in sight. Total devastation. And they're putting these in patches, spreading them maybe with an acre or two in between each one. And their plan is to go back and cut out the intervening areas next year or the year after. My understanding is that they plan on cutting 1-2% of the watershed every year so that within 50 years there'll be nothing left except the shrubs and invasive species that grow back.
Will that fuel their brand new biomass burner in the visitor center?
You know, their biomass furnace at the visitor center would take, I think, a very small amount of acreage to sustain. It's not a big operation. This is kind of a giveaway program for local, not even local, harvesters, timber harvesters. They come from New Hampshire. They come from all over the place. The logs mostly go up to Canada to be processed. So it's protected watershed land. It's been protected and purchased by the state to protect it because of the water quality for 2.5 million people living in the Boston area.
What's her definition of protected?
Well, that's what I want to know. You're not allowed to walk in the areas. You're not allowed to ride any vehicles. You're not allowed to take your dogs for a walk. You're not allowed to ride horses in the area. You're not allowed to do anything that could potentially pollute or lower the water quality in the Quabbin, which does have very high quality water.
And you're not allowed to go down the Prescott Peninsula.
You're not allowed to stand foot on the Prescott Peninsula.
And go down and visit the Abigail and Daniel Shays home site.
That's right.
Art history.
You are not allowed to see that, but they allow monstrous equipment in and logging trucks and equipment that spews out all kinds of petroleum products and, of course, removing the entire forest. It's not forestry, it's deforestation.
But
it's
what would
complete
you do?
Slob
what
forestry.
Would you do without all those toothpicks?
There's nothing left when they're
what
done.
What would you do with all the toothpicks and all the wooden sticks we eat with in the Chinese restaurants?
Well, I'd probably use a plastic toothpick. As a matter of fact, I do. Anyway, the idea behind protecting land and then going in and raping and pillaging it is just absurd.
I think so. What grows into these clear cuts?
What comes back is a variety of shrubby little spindly trees that takes 20 or 30 years before anything can even walk through those areas because they're so densely. There's no management that occurs. I mean, it's a misnomer to think that what they're doing is management. What they're doing is just deforestation. That's the only way you can describe it. It's cut and run forestry. And what they're doing is they're wiping out a forest that is just beginning to have some age class and some diversity and some structure to it, and they're replacing it with a forest that will, again, take another 40 or 50 years to have any value to wildlife. Mm-hmm. They're wiping out some trees that are 95-year-old oak trees. We counted the rings on them. So those trees are just getting into their early 20s, say, not even midlife, starting to produce healthy crops of nuts and things. They're wiping them out, and they're letting whatever grows back, grow back, which is in a lot of cases just scrub and invasive species. Mm-hmm. So that's what we saw, especially around the New Salem. The north part of the Quabbin seems to be much worse than the southern part as far as the kind of clear cutting that they're doing. Mm-hmm. But our goal from this walk is to raise awareness and to call for the immediate firing of Herm Eck, who is the forester on the Quabbin, and to have him replaced with a conservation biologist, and to have some real watershed protection start happening in the Quabbin.
Because the Quabbin used to be sort of a showcase for, right, eco-forestry?
It was at one time, but I don't know how long it's been since that kind of thing has been happening. It is now, it's a disaster, and I'm going to say that my prediction is it's going to be going downhill based on the kind of mismanagement that's happening. So we did Quabbin Walk 1, we're going to do Quabbin Walk 2, and we're going to keep walking and keep protesting and escalating if necessary to stop the commercial exploitation and destruction of the watershed.
So this cutting, it wasn't for biomass that you know of, right? It was...
No. This is commercial deforestation.
Hardwoods to Canada. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think this probably brings us to our guest, because a lot of invasive species are growing into what were once clear cuts. Were they not?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, we have with us today here in the studio is Don Wakaluk, who was assistant forester for the DCR from 07 to 09. So, Don, after hearing this, what do you think about the situation that's going on right now in the Quabbin with these clear cuts?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious from just the look of the cuts themselves. What we're talking about here is agroforestry. The attempt to regrow these forests in any way that is beneficial to these ecosystems is it's just extremely unlikely if you're talking about natural regrowth. You guys said you saw stump-sprouted birches and red maples and things like that growing back in these clear cuts. And, you know, the foresters really hate the term clear cut. They like to use the terms patch cut and successional cut, and you know, there's a lot of nicety terms that you can use to sort of soften the blow that you're removing a chunk of the ecosystem for profit.
The even age management, is that another one?
Well, see, uneven age management would be the overall goal, right? I mean, if we had Herm here, he would tell us how he's only cutting certain areas and only a certain amount of those areas, and he moves it around. He has a cut on one side of the Quabbin and then a cut on the other side, and you know, they are scattering their harvesting, their commercial harvesting, to the point that they're not really affecting the overall forest. And here's where I differ in opinion. The evidence points, and my data that I collected over the last 3 years, last two seasons, mapping invasives, suggests that these clear cuts are going to become nothing but a harbor for invasives. In fact, the evidence is really slanted in favor of what they're doing is dismantling the ecosystem.
Yeah, exactly. Let me take a little like non sequitur break here for a second. I have Meg Sheehan on the line. Meg, are you with us?
I'm with you.
All right. I just want to interrupt Don for a second and have you tell us about the Stop Spewing Carbon campaign that's happening right now to continue the process of getting signatures on a petition, a ballot initiative. If you could fill us in on that just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll go back to Don. Thanks, Meg.
Sure. The Stop Spewing Carbon campaign is in the final leg of our effort to get a question on the November 2010 statewide ballot that would limit the amount of carbon dioxide emissions from incinerators that burn garbage and trash for so-called green electricity.
And this would also cut out the energy subsidies for dirty biomass incinerators too, right?
Exactly, yeah. These incinerators are called biomass incinerators and also waste energy or garbage incinerators. We need 11,000 certified signatures by June 23rd to make the final hurdle to get on the ballot. Anybody who wants to help us out can go to www.stopspewingcarbon.com carbon.org. Download the petition there. Mail it back to us. The instructions are there. All you have to do is sign your name and your address. You can help us out. You can also give us a call at 800-729-1363. And we're making national news with this campaign. This will be the first in the nation law.
All eyes are on Massachusetts right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, yesterday 90 scientists told Congress
right.
to close the loophole in the law that put biomass incinerators on equal footing with clean energy.
Right.
Well, we're doing the same thing in Massachusetts. We actually have a specific law that we want to get passed by the voters to put an end to these toxic incinerators.
Right on. All right. Thanks for calling in, Meg. And for folks that want to help out with that effort, we have a few weeks to go. Please look at www.stopspewingcarbon.org or call 1-800-729-1363. We need grassroots help to stop the biomonster. Thanks, Meg.
You're welcome, Glenn. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Meg.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye to you.
All right. Thanks, Sheehan.
All right. Sorry to interrupt, Don, but we had her on the line there. And
no, that's cool. I'm so glad that they've decided to join in this effort. You know, I mean, it's really going to wake people up in Boston.
Well, yeah, part of this clear cutting that has been happening on state lands has been to supply biomass wood chips for these incinerators. And right. if they put in the five incinerators that are planned for Western Mass, we'll see incredible increases in clear cutting and logging on our state forests and also on a lot of other sensitive lands.
Right.
So back to the question of...
Better build a fence around your own trees in your backyard if they start burning at the rate they expect to burn.
Yeah, each one of these large facilities will burn a ton a minute of wood. So,
I mean, what's the thinking there? I mean, how long is that going to be sustainable for?
Yeah, it's not sustainable. Yeah, yep. But anyway, let's get back to the Quabbin and to what I would call, you know, complete mismanagement. And you were on a roll there when I interrupted
you.
You
know, I mean, you just touched on it again. I mean, what we're really talking about here is mismanagement at the top level.
Right.
And what it comes down to is prioritization. What do you prioritize when you're managing, you know, millions of acres of forest? Can one person do a job like that? I mean, some people would say, well, it's the Board of Forestry and it's the service foresters scout, you know, throughout the state that are, you know, engaged with landowners that are sort of explaining to them the need to have harvest management plans. But really, all this is timber speak. It's harvesting commercial trees for the purpose of agroforestry, quick turnover. And the result from that type of quick in, quick out forestry without any purposeful, intentional replanting is regeneration of junk. What we're doing is we're creating forests that are not resilient. And the big argument has been resilience. That and they love to quote the 1938 hurricane. And
all the time.
What overturned all these huge trees. Well, those were old growth trees, very large trees. And when we lost a lot of them, well, they made big openings in the forest. And the regrowth at the time, well, it wasn't so bad because the invasives hadn't had an opportunity to spread the way they have now.
When we're talking about invasive species, let's sort of define what that means as far as invasive species.
So invasive really is a term that's given by a group of scientists in Massachusetts that. Their purpose is to define when a species has become, it grows beyond the ability of the surrounding to recover, meaning it occupies a niche. The species occupies a niche and steals it from a native species.
Starts excluding other natural, normal species.
We've all seen this. These foundation plantings that we have around our homes, Japanese barberry is a common one. When it gets loose in the forest, it dominates the understory. And I don't mean just a few plants here and there and then other native things grow back. The barberry takes over and completely shades out all the forbs on the forest floor. When I take people to see these sites out at Quabbin and I pull back the Japanese barberry, they can see that the ground is bare beneath it. Now, it's no wonder that not only have the forbs disappeared and many probably endangered species have disappeared, but we're also talking about species like the New England cottontail. That story was just recently in the Boston Globe.
Right.
Well, one of the chief reasons for the disappearance of small game from these areas is invasive species have nothing to offer these creatures. Escape cover is often given as the, oh, well, they can substitute for native species. Well, multifloral rose, when it grows down to the ground with its half-inch long thorns, is not so friendly to little rabbits. And cottontail rabbits, who need nesting cover on the surface of the ground and need those forbs to eat, really just can't live in that type of habitat, and so they disappear quickly. And the sad story is that there are places like Enfield Lookout at the Quabbin in the park, where 17 acres of barberry occupy the understory. Now, this is an area where bald eagles traditionally, when they were reintroduced into Quabbin, were hunting. They were gaining, you know, they were getting that small window of opportunity in spring to grab small game and feed that to their young. Mm-hmm. Now they're relying on fishing sources only because that small game population has dwindled to next to nothing in most of the park.
Yeah. I've been in some places in the Quabbin where you cannot walk through the forest because, I mean, I guess you could if you had on some kind of thorn-proof, you know, heavy canvas coveralls or something.
Yeah, I would make my student assistants wear chaps out in the field.
You would have right. to be wearing something That's like right. that because these Japanese barberries have so many thorns on them. You can't push your way through them.
And that's just one of the species. I mean, you know, there was Japanese barberry. There was Oriental bittersweet. Everyone knows that as strangler vine.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You see it up and down our highways everywhere you go.
Yeah.
Well, there's one site in Quabbin Park. And now this is within a mile of the visitor center, a mile of the headquarters. One of the most highly maintained areas on the Quabbin is the park. And there's 243 acres of bittersweet in one spot. Now, this is an old clear cut. How did it get there? Well, perhaps it was along the stone walls. Maybe it was there back when this was, you know, these were towns. But most likely the case was there were just a few there, and it just took two or three decades of non-management to allow it to proliferate. And now it's proliferated to the point to where it's too late. These ecologies are lost.
Well, how could we get rid of this? I mean, how do we get rid of this? How do we get rid of the barberry and the strangler vine?
So the foresters would say active forestry. Mm-hmm. And they would, you know, they would intimate that by cutting down the forests and by cutting down the trees and creating these uneven-aged forests, we're going to deny these invasives the opportunity to take
well,
that's
over. That's ridiculous. That's like cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Exactly. And you know, when you look at these sites, when you go to these cuts, I mean, you can see foresters, you know, they're conscientious out there. They don't want the loggers bulldozing their way through wetlands and streams and stone walls, and so they protect them in their forest management plans. And so the loggers studiously avoid these spots because they don't want to get in trouble with the foresters. Everyone knows it's the toughest forestry out in the state is going on in Quabbin, and these guys are really hard on loggers.
Wait a minute. We used to went to a clear cut where the loggers went right through a historic stone wall and covered up a wetland area.
Thank you. Exactly.
With corduroy roads, they put logs right through the whole wetlands.
So and I can show, the data clearly shows, I can show you on my model here that wherever we find these clear cuts or any of these larger openings, where they've accessed the areas, where there are log landings, they have dragged the barberry with them. If you go to my Facebook page and look at the pictures that I've posted there that have to do with the invasives out of Quabbin, you'll note that they're managing with brush hogs. Well, when you brush hog things, you mow things down to the ground, the idea is that you're removing them, but really all you're doing is pruning them. And in the case of things like Japanese knotweed, you can find almost anywhere on Prescott Peninsula in any of the cuts. or at least adjacent on the roads to any of those cuts, and all of the drainage ditches that lead back and forth from those cuts that are connected with streams, that are connected with the reservoir. All of those areas have been maintained by mowing with brush hogs and tractors, and what they've done is they've spread the seed, because when do they actually do the mowing? Well, they do it in spring and in summer when they've got guys working. That's the problem with having a DCR that is seasonal and temporary and unbenefited. They put workers in the field when it's convenient for their schedules. And instead, what happens is we have seasonal management of our problem resource areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So listeners might want to check out that Facebook page, Don. What's the address?
Go to Don Wakoluk, WAKOLUK, at Facebook, and you can click on the invasive plant tragedy that's going on out of Quabbin.
And we'll link to it on our blog as well.
Now, areas that we are hiking in around New Salem, we walk through the woods, and you know, the woods are pretty nice. There's not a lot of invasive species in the understory. But then you go into the areas that have been cut, and basically there's nothing left. But adjacent to those are old cutover areas, and you can see that the understory is solid barberry. And it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that barberry is going to invade into that new clear-cut area.
Well, you guys took that walk around the Quabbin.
Yeah.
And, you know, you must have seen some nice areas, right? I mean, if you're walking along 202, there are some sites that were logged nicely, and, boy, they did a great job. The slash isn't too high, and you see some regeneration going on. But what kind of regeneration do you see going on? You see a forest of birch saplings. You see a forest of stump sprouts. You know, if there's anyone out there that actually believes that the biodiversity of the Quabbin is intact and is being maintained by these current forestry practices, then they need to spend some time in the woods. They need to walk around out there and just walk from one area that hasn't been cut to an area that has been cut. Mm-hmm. And just look at the forest floor and the composition of the forest floor. When you say you saw open areas, I mean, old growth forest has lots of open areas, and boy, we don't see invasives all the time in old growth forests, right? So what's so different?
It was
the composition that you start with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it, you know, by opening up these areas in the presence of high dense populations of invasives, what they have essentially done is thrown away the key. There is no way to repair these. I can't say this enough times. I've said it in the Boston Globe. I've said it in discussions at the forest visioning process. We cannot recover these areas. They are lost forever.
Well, that's something has to be possible to change this. You're telling us that what is happening here is the destruction of the environment. I mean, that's what's happening, and we can't do anything about it. Is there no way? I mean, if you had a whole new forestry service that was committed to trying to protect the forest and not to cut it down or do anything bad with it.
Yeah, I just want to say that we have Chris Matera just on the phone here with us. Hi, Chris, you there?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey,
good.
Chris.
Good. Hey, Chris.
We're talking about the invasive species problem in the Quabbin. You probably have been hearing it for a while. And Gene has a good point. Is there anything that can be done, or are we just looking at the gradual downhill spiral and decline of the Quabbin watershed?
Because it's sort of like you're suggesting to us, just walk away. There's nothing you can do.
Well,
and that can't be true.
If you read the Harvard Forest Report, I mean, that is sort of what they're suggesting, that we should do nothing, the do-nothing approach. And I mean, I go back and forth on this, but I am firmly convinced that intentional forestry, if we were to plant these areas, now I know the argument goes back and forth about the costs of planting, but I mean, really, what we're talking about here is saving what's left. We're not talking about some whole-scale effort to fix all of the state's forests. We're just trying to capture and save, what, that 70%? No, we're that 10% that the Harvard Forest report talks about?
Right.
Well, we can, stop clear-cutting now, at least stop making the situation worse,
right?
and then try and fix the places that are already messed up. if possible, you know.
Yeah, I would expect that if there's any place in the state that could have the financial ability, you know, and a steady income, it would be the Quabbin watershed, because that water is, you know, really valuable to all the people in Boston.
Right.
And it's really the people in Boston that should be concerned about the deterioration of their water supply. And that's, it's pretty obvious that the trend in the Quabbin is really not good. It's very bad. And to have them going in, like you said, and clear-cutting continuously, their plan is to wipe out the existing forest that's there now over the next 25 to 30 years, what's left.
And the amazing thing is we're paying to cut it down instead of paying to restore it. The logging program loses money in the Quabbin and on the other state forests, so we're literally as citizens paying to cut down our own state forests.
Yeah,
and a lot of people are fooled into this idea that when they do these harvests, that someone's going back in and replanting them.
Right,
and that's a common misunderstanding. There are no intentional forestry projects going on right now. Yes, there have been some in the past, some experiments, some exclusion experiments when they were trying to determine whether or not the white-tailed deer population could be controlled in other ways than a hunt. You know, the bottom line is, we're not really even talking so much about the fact that they're cutting down the forests. We're just talking about the fact that we're losing ecologies entirely, in their entirety.
Right.
And my example is here, an area that hasn't been logged are the islands out on the Quabbin. Mm. And yet those islands in many places are completely covered by Phragmites. Now, you know, you say, well, who cares? It's just a little island. It's not really affecting anything. Those are ancient mountaintops that were in the Swift River Valley. Those are now covered by Phragmites. This is the endangered species habitat for lake loons, and they can't use that habitat anymore. The eagles can't hunt in those areas anymore because they can't catch anything in those shallows. And Chris is absolutely right when he talks about this sort of agroforestry approach that they're using. You know, the justification for cutting down the trees is it's for the forest's health. Well, it can't be for the forest's health if what you're doing is you're robbing the biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So I think that part of this discussion has to focus on the change, a drastic, radical change in the management. And I don't want to use that with a negative connotation, but obviously the mismanagement that's occurring, there has to be a radical change. And like I said, I'm very much in favor of firing Herm Eck, the current chief forester on the Quabbin, and replacing him with a conservation biologist, somebody who understands what we're losing mm-hmm. and what we are going to continue to lose, and do an active job of trying to turn that around with all the resources that are available.
Yeah. The other important thing to think about, too, is the EPA granted a waiver to the state. I'm putting a filtration plant in. It's a $200 million filtration plant because the state was committed to protecting the forest around the Quabbin. So, you know, that mismanagement is not only threatening the ecology, which it is, but it's also threatening that waiver from the EPA. So, you know, the amount of money that they get from logging is so small. I mean, it's $600,000 a year or so on a $600 million budget, and they're risking a $200 million filtration plant. So, it's really crazy. There's, you know, we're not only wrecking the ecology, but we are really threatening the economy, too. So,
yeah, yep. My understanding is that the people in the eastern part of the state actually don't understand what's happening to the Quabbin. They're kind of not in the loop, and they manage the water resource once it leaves the Quabbin, but they're kind of leaving the management of the watershed to DCR because they're supposed to be the experts. And yet, as you've pointed out, Chris, DCR is, they have nothing to do with conservation, very little to do with recreation. They're out there really destroying some beautiful habitats. And it's something that we really have to focus on. And either legislatively or as activists, we need to stop this.
And you know, what Dio brought up, this does dovetail in with the biomass plants, because the state-sponsored report looking at how much so-called wood is available in Massachusetts for biomass plants identifies 55% of the wood to come from state public lands. Mm. So it's no coincidence that all of a sudden the logging is ramping up.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're running out of time, aren't we?
I don't know.
In many ways. Yeah. I mean, the whole question of the biodiversity of this area is, I don't understand why people don't understand that.
Well, you know, I'm just going to say that the Quabbin has the potential to be a large interior core habitat for species that require large unfragmented forests.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's really the only place in the state that has that real potential, especially in the center of the state.
Well, that's the way it was considered for decades.
Yeah.
You know, I hear the argument all the time from the foresters that say, well, you know, you guys are talking about hands-off management. You're talking about recreating old growth forest in New England, and how realistic is that to think that we could do that sort of thing? Well, I've heard some suggestions out there that we could manage with fire. I've heard some other suggestions that perhaps we should turn over the management of all the state's forests, not to the Board of Forestry, not to DCR, but to the Division of Ecological Restoration under Fish and Game, under Natural Heritage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the intent and purpose of trying to preserve this large chunk of forest and large chunk of the biosphere as a biosphere reserve. I mean, it's funny, you go to Europe or Asia or any other country, any other, you know, they're taking these steps now.
Right.
They're preserving these areas now. Right. How much longer do we need to wait? Do we need to see the invasives on our own doorsteps surrounding our own homes replacing the forests that are all around us? I guarantee you, if we continue this sort of patchwork approach to managing the state's forests, this sort of Band-Aid approach, that within a decade, we will see areas that are unrecoverable.
Yeah. So I guess...
Well, that should be the theme that we really end on, is to try to think about how to get the state to accept Quabbin as a biosphere.
Yes,
as a biosphere
reserve. Yeah.
I mean, New York State has 20% of their forests in forever wild reserves where they can't log it. Massachusetts, after all the hullabaloo about the Forest Futures Vision process, in fact, only 6% of the state forests. All the forests in the state are off limits to commercial logging in state parks and forests and reserves. I mean, it's only 6%, so...
Well, you know, Chris, that they left Quabbin out of that equation, and they left all the division of fish and game lands out of that equation.
Exactly, right. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, we like to pretend we're this conscious state, this liberal conscious state that has an environmental bent to it, and here we'd like to tell people and Brazil that they should save their rainforest and all that, but we're only willing to set aside 6% of our forests. You know, it's really pretty hypocritical.
Well, it sounds to me that everything I've heard tonight is really the beginnings of a really strong statewide press for this exactly to happen, and that it ought to be happening. Mm-hmm. For example, to put something on the ballot against the biomass, this is even bigger and better. I mean, because the biomass, the running of the biomass incinerators is going to take place by cutting down more of the Quabbin and more of Massachusetts forests. So this is even more of an issue that all of the environmental groups should take up and all of the colleges should take up.
Yeah.
It has to be something big because it is something big.
Well, you know, of all the areas that we scouted and measured out there, we came up with about 853 acres of invasives out of close to 10,000 acres that we ended up scouting on land masses. That's about 13% of the area that we scouted was completely covered by invasives. Those high-density populations that are out there would be the place to start. If we were going to try to do something, and we have to try to do something soon, that would be where we would start. And boy, you know, I've been laid off since September from DCR, and so many other people.
I hear
know.
Conservation Corps. Did anyone say Conservation Corps?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, my wife likes to bring up the YCC. I'd love to see my daughter planting trees.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. Okay, we got to wrap this up. Chris, anything you want to say before you ring off?
Just anybody who can help, collect some signatures. Stopspewingcarbon.com. Get some signatures in the next few weeks.
Very good.
Most I'll important thing right now.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Right on. Take it easy.
Bye.
Bye.
All right.
You want to do the mailbox?
And Don Wachlach's Facebook page for some of the photos of invasive species. Just go to Facebook and type in Don, W-A-K-O-L-U-K. And we'll also link to that on our blog. Just Google in the Enviro Show for that. We can do a little bus stop billboard now. Gene, you want to do that with me?
Sure. You want to start?
Okay, Wednesday, May 26, 2:30 to 4 p.m., the Central Labor Council, 640 Page Boulevard, Springfield, a dialogue between labor proponents and opponents of biomass incineration power plants. Labor and community proponents and opponents of biomass need to find their many points of unity in the broader struggle for a green economy.
On May 27th through June 6th, the Mountain Justice Summer Camp. As the campaign to stop all forms of surface mining gains national awareness, we have more and more opportunities for folks to devote a summer of work to stopping mountaintop removal. Go to http://www.mountainjusticesummer.org.
Friday the 28th, Tom Hartman comes to town right here at First Churches. Go to www.whmp.com. We'll have a table there, and we're with Jobs with Justice table and Valley Free Radio. Check that out.
Wednesday, June 9th, 4:30 to 5:30 p.m., a rally is planned prior to the Massachusetts DEP hearing on the Global Warming Solutions Act to be held at the Springfield Federal Building, 1550 Main Street in Springfield, outside of Senator Kerry's office. Join a coalition of concerned citizens for clean air to get our voices, let our voices be heard to express opposition to dirty incinerators disguised as clean energy. A coalition of concerned citizens like Stop Toxic Incinerators in Springfield and Stop Spewing Carbon are sponsoring the event. More info at stopspewingcarbon@gmail.com or call toll-free 1-800-729-1363.
Thursday, June 10th, 7 to 8:30 p.m., coyotes are everywhere. And you recall the last show we talked about coyotes in the backyard. Have you heard their yipping and their choruses? What do they prey on? Who are their predators? Hitchcock Center for the Environment, 525 South Pleasant Street in Amherst. Pre-registration required. Call 256-6006. And you know what? I think we're just about out of time. We can have the put the others on.
We still got a couple minutes.
Oh, yeah? Okay, Gene, go.
Two.
Okay. Thursday, June 17th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. What's happening with fish in the Connecticut River? Join hatchery manager Mickey Novak for an extremely interesting talk about the change in population numbers of Atlantic salmon, shad, blueback, heron, and striped bass. Great Falls Discovery Center, Avenue A, Turner's Falls. Call 413-863-3221.
And finally, June 19th, 10:30 a.m. to 7 p.m., this is the 6th Annual Sustainable Energy Summit 2010. And that's at Nueces Races, 24 Jones Ferry Road, Holyoke. And you want info on that, you call Diane Crow at 413-772-8898 or email summit@coop.power.coop. All right. Next up is Antidote Radio. Next time this week, next week at this time, will be our sister show, Farm to Fork, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. This is Dio saying adios.
And this is Glenn Ayers saying see ya.
And good night, everybody, from Gene.
Thanks again to Don.
Thanks again.
And thanks, Don, for coming in. Being on the Enviro Show
and teaching us something we needed to know.
What do you want to go out with, Glenn?
Nothing. We'll just crank up this little embryonic
journey
and fade away.
Jefferson Airplane.